Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are two of your hosts, Ben Yanowitz
and Jordan Yanowitz. Over the past 6 weeks, we have seen a mass movement, which began at Columbia University and has swept across college campuses across the world. Here in California, we have seen Palestine solidarity encampments across universities, and especially in the UC system. From UCLA to Cal Berkeley to UC Davis and our hometown university, UC Santa Cruz, we have also seen a historic strike of UC academic workers who are standing up against the unfair labor practices imposed by the UC as part of its repressive efforts to silence the Palestine solidarity movement.
For this episode, which I recorded in my childhood home, which means that there was a dog that was coming in and out, so if you hear anything a little bit weird, that would be the cause, I interviewed Rebecca Gross and Max Sarosi. Both of our guests are student organizers for Jews Against White Supremacy, or JAWS, at UC Santa Cruz. JAWS is a militant anti-Zionist Jewish group that has taken hardline stances in support of Palestinians' resistance to settler colonialism.
Rebecca is also a leader of the UC Academic Workers Union, in which I am a part, UAW 4811. Since May 15th, UAW 4811 has been mobilizing across campuses throughout the UC, beginning at UC Santa Cruz, in response to their unfair labor practices.
Before we go on to the interview, we would like to thank our donors, without whom this podcast would not be able to continue. If you like what we are doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice, consider joining our donor community on Patreon, follow us on Instagram, and share our content with your communities.
Without further ado, enjoy the conversation.
We are beautiful people.
Rebecca, Max, it's really exciting to sit down with you guys. Today we're going to be talking about the uprisings and the student movement and faculty movement at UCSC, which the University of California in Santa Cruz is not my own personal university. However, both my parents are alum, and I grew up in Santa Cruz. We are currently sitting in my childhood home living room, which is pretty cool to be able to really root diasporism, to root our politics in the place we are, in the place I grew up. You guys have coming from other places, but you're part of the community in UCSC. You guys are organizers and students. And as most people who don't have their head buried in the sand will know, there's been student movement going on across the country for the last several months. At UCSC, there was the encampment. And more recently, you have the strikes led by the UAW 4811. And we're going to get to that shortly. But to start, I was wondering if each of you could tell us a little bit about yourselves and what do you do at UCSC as students, as organizers?
Yeah, so my name is Max. I grew up in Mill Valley, California, which is like 2 hours from here. I think it is like important to say that I did go to Jewish day school for 9 years, K through eight. I mean, we can get more into that. I'm a third year at UCSC. I transferred last year. I study agroecology and critical race and ethnic studies. I helped start the Jews Against White Supremacy chapter at UCSC back in, I think it was like late October, early November. But before that, I was organizing with UCSC Mauna Kea Protectors and just kind of more like generally with the like Divest Coalition.
And I'm Rebecca. I am a third year graduate student and I usually work as a TA. I'm in the literature department. I've been organizing with UAW 4811 for the past 3 years, the entire time I've been here. I like to joke that my first meeting at UCSC was not for my literature degree. It was actually with the union. This is my second time actually being on strike since I've been here. A lot of the comrades that I organize with, actually, this is their third time being on strike. And we have a little three strikes, you're out joke that's going on right now. So I can say more about all of that. But I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to college in Seattle, moved back to LA. And then it really wasn't until I kind of came to Santa Cruz that I started to organize a little bit in LA around like Black Lives Matter. But then when I really got to Santa Cruz, it was like, this felt like a really great place to organize. And there's a rich history of that here. And so to be able to kind of join that movement and that community has been really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that rich history of radicalism, student radicalism, isn't really something I was raised with. I actually learned just a couple days ago, my parents both went to UCSC from 1984 to 1988. And I actually didn't know this, but my parents were also involved in the apartheid divestment movement against South Africa at the time. And I found that really interesting. And I'm kind of wondering if there's possibly any similar slogans, because I know the current movement is all about divestment. And I'd be curious to know more about the history. I don't know if you know at all. But could you say a little bit about the radical history? Because I actually don't know as much as I'd like to.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I can say less about sort of the history at Santa Cruz, you know, in terms of like apartheid and divestment. Maybe Max, I don't know if you know about it. But there's been a lot of movements like across like all UC campuses also to like work towards divestment. Mm-hmm. And this has been achieved at various times. So like it was achieved in the anti-apartheid movement. It was achieved also, I believe, in some anti-militarization work in the early 2000s. We're also doing this. But I'm really thinking about kind of like this much more recent history, which starts really in like 2018 with graduate workers basically getting a shit contract and deciding like, instead of just kind of laying down and, you know, rolling over and saying, well, there's nothing we can do about it, people started organizing and said, we have to do something about it. Like, we do not have enough money to live where we're hired to work. Yeah. And so then we saw this cost of living adjustment or COLA movement pick up kind of speed in Santa Cruz and really like gain traction. And in 2019-2020, there was a wildcat strike here at UC Santa Cruz. And actually, it's kind of what put Santa Cruz on the map for me as a place I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I'm working right now at a university in LA. It was a private university. It was Loyola Marymount. I was working as a teacher, but I was getting a stipend. I also wasn't getting paid enough to live where I was working. And I didn't have a union. And I looked at the example here and was like, this is really amazing what they're doing. And actually, it was COVID that shut down that picket. But the movement continued. Many students similarly in that movement received student conduct charges. There were mass arrests, although many, many more arrests this time, which Max will say more about. It ignited like a rank and file movement across the entire state. What we saw come out of that was a modest housing stipend at UCSC, but it made it so that in our next contract fight, the cost of living adjustment demand was embedded in that new contract that we were bargaining over. Unfortunately, we didn't end up getting that, but it's still something that we're working towards. And I will say, like, you know, we went on a 6-week strike in 2022 over this. And like these multiple strikes have definitely allowed us to get where we are now. And so has the student movement, which, you know, we're entering week 3 of our strike, and I'm assuming it's going to be going for a few more unless the UC, right, chooses to end it by meeting our demands, which they haven't done.
So the UAW 4811 is not that old, I don't believe. And I think it was actually quite historic when it was formed because it is a single bargaining unit. Is it a single bargaining unit?
Yeah, so UAW 4811 was basically an amalgamation of two unions, UAW 2865 and UAW 5810. And in the 2022 strike, both of those units were bargaining at the same time, and both of us went on strike, which was 48,000 workers across 11 campuses. So when we combined, we became UAW 4811, 48,000 workers, 11 campuses. But even 2865, like which was the grad workers union, wasn't very old. It was started in, I believe, 2000 or like late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, it was revolutionary when it was started too, because it wasn't common for grad workers to have unions. It's been pretty amazing what has been kind of built from that going forward. And it's bizarre. It's really weird to have a local that's like across an entire state with 48,000 people. And in this strike, we've seen it like give us a lot of power.
Yeah, it's probably the largest single grad student union in the country.
It might be. I think that's probably right. Yeah. It's, I mean, the UC system is just ginormous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it the first, like, labor strike for Palestine in the U.S.?
I think so. Like, yeah. I definitely think that, like, my hope with this strike is that people will look to this example. And I, should I just say a bit about, like, what we're striking over and kind of what happened?
Yeah. I was thinking of organizing it differently, but I think this logically goes into this because you're in a pretty big strike right now. My brother, who's been a grad student worker at UCLA, or technically he's a TA, he's not really like taking class. It's complicated.
But that's like, but that's what it, like the thing is like, so the people that are in UAW 4811 are teaching assistants, grad student instructors that are teaching their own classes, undergraduate tutors, undergraduate readers, postdocs, academic researchers, and like grad student researchers. So this is like a lot of people with different job titles and also like course assistants. So like, for example, someone who was arrested the other night is a course assistant, but she's not a student.
Yeah.
So you can be hired like to do the work of a TA, but not be a student. And therefore you're in our bargaining unit as well.
Yeah. What I was saying is that my brother is part of the union at UCLA and has been telling me about how repressive the police presence has been against the strikes and against, of course, the student movement more broadly. But it does make me kind of think about how these two things relate to each other, because legally, we were talking about this before we hit record, according to Taft-Hartley, which is the labor law that was passed in 1947 after the biggest strike wave in U.S. history following the end of World War II from 1945 to 1946, you're not legally allowed to strike for political solidarity purposes. You're only legally allowed to strike over really discrete workplace issues.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were saying, this is a strike that, while it is focused on unfair labor practices, it also does connect to the student movement. So before we go towards the strike, I actually want to kind of rewind a little bit. And both of you are also organizers of Jews Against White Supremacy, as Max was saying before. So could you tell us a little bit about what Jews Against White Supremacy is on campus and how it relates to the student movement more broadly today?
Let's see. I got involved with JAWS via Twitter. And, you know, one of the principal people who invented JAWS, I was following for a while. And they kind of just like put a call out in like August of 2023, being like, who wants to help me build this organization? And it was just kind of on my radar. And then after October 7th, I was like, there is a need for a Jewish anti-Zionist organization on this campus. And what I appreciated about JAWS was that it did several things that I did not see being done by Jewish anti-Zionist organizations. And the first is it's focused on internationalism and recognizing that the struggle for liberation is beyond the scope of Palestine. Of course, it involves Palestine, but like what we see organizations like JVP, if not now, all these orgs are focused on anti-Zionism in the context of Palestine versus anti-Zionism as part of this like more broad internationalist context. And that's where like the focus on white supremacy comes from, like, and understanding white supremacy as like a global structure that is, you know, deeply tied to, you know, capitalism, imperialism, and all these things, right? And so that's what I appreciate about this organization, is that it broadened the scope, but it also took a much more militant approach to Zionist institutions, but particularly Jewish Zionist institutions, right? So we're talking about like, you know, Hillel, we're talking about the ADL, we're talking about, I mean, even Jewish synagogues, right? And so like understanding like the role that these institutions play in perpetuating and reproducing Zionism and understanding that any like anti-Zionism that is really, you know, gonna try and like shift things is gonna have to focus on Jewish Zionist institutions and not just the state of Israel, right? Which is what you see kind of JVP, if not now, that cohort of Jewish anti-Zionist organizations focus on.
Yeah, so I first found out about JAWS through the internet. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, is this basically just an Instagram page and a Twitter? And frankly, it kind of seemed like that's what it was.
It fully was, yeah, for a while, yeah.
But at the same time, one of my discomforts with some of the way it presented itself was this focus on abolishing Zionist Jewish institutions as its raison d'être, which I found a little strange. Like you mentioned, including Jewish synagogues, many of which are Zionist. And for me, I am back here in Santa Cruz. I'm actually working at Temple Beth El, which is the main Jewish, and frankly, it's like the main Jewish community center here in Santa Cruz, in the Santa Cruz area. And it is part of the URJ. The URJ is explicitly a Zionist Jewish institution.
Right.
And for me, the question of abolishing it as your primary goal feels overly negative in the sense that it's opposing something without necessarily presenting an alternative, without putting the emphasis on constructive work.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, my other part of my discomfort was the fact that it's Jews against white supremacy, but its entire focus is on Zionism. And my thinking was, yes, you can understand Zionism as a manifestation of white supremacy. I think that's a completely valid way to understand Zionism. But also, shouldn't it be also focused on like the Black Lives Matter movement and other stuff? How would you guys as JAWS organizers respond to my discomfort and criticism?
Yeah, I would say that the first one, I certainly have heard that from a lot of people. And I think like thinking about the word abolishing more in like an abolitionist context and like understanding like the work of abolition is constructive in the sense that it's like in order to build these things, we actually have to destroy these kind of oppressive institutions, right? Like, you know, it's not necessarily to simply destroy for the sake of destroying. Like, yeah, like I think
it's like a phoenix burning it up to create something new.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's like if we're to understand Zionism as an ideology of white supremacy, then we need to understand it as something that does need to be destroyed, right? And so I think that's kind of where JAWS approaches it from, right? It's like it's rooted in genocide, settler colonialism, and logics of white supremacy, right? Theodor Herzl writing that, you know, the project of Israel was to build a rampart of civilization in, you know, what he's called was like a sea of barbarism. I don't know if those were his exact words, but certainly along those lines, right? Right, that's like very much white supremacist logic at work that was also at work in so many other settler colonial projects. And so we need to understand that as Zionism is something that needs to be destroyed. And we are certainly not the first people to say that. You know, I've been reading Thomas Sankara lately. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, despite, you know, leading the revolution in Burkina Faso, was very much engaging with Zionism and talking about how, like, their struggle in Burkina Faso was also aligned with the struggle of Palestinians. And I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second part that you were saying was about its like primary focus on Zionism, even though it's saying like Jews against white supremacy. And I totally agree. And I think it's just kind of a reflection of this moment, which it kind of got birthed in, yes, a few months prior to October 7th, but it really gained steam after October 7th. And I think it was just kind of like an all hands on deck situation where it's like, we need to be like fighting Zionism at all costs right now.
I was looking back at the initial statement, and it emphasized that it was formed to fight for the liberation of Palestine by any means possible as its impetus.
Yeah.
So it was specifically formed around the need for a Jewish-Palestinian liberation movement. But at the same time, I guess it's just kind of strange for me where I'm like, I'm working in what could be argued as a Zionist Jewish institution and seeing how it's possible, especially if you have the social privileges that I have of being raised in this community and having good personal relationships with the rabbinic leadership, it's possible to actually engage with these in a way that isn't necessarily like purely oppositional, but instead trying to work within them. And it sounds, of course, this sounds like the age-old argument between reformism and revolution. But I guess I was just wondering, do you see any space for that kind of work within the JAWS sort of theory of change?
I mean, I think that something that we've talked a lot about is that like de-Zionizing is necessary, but it doesn't necessarily need to happen within JAWS. So I think that if not now, does a lot of work de-Zionizing, for example. And like there are these other Jewish organizations that are focused on that de-Zionizing project. For example, like the film Israelism, Jaws did a screening of it. I actually think that's where we met.
Yep.
You know, we had a lot of critiques of it. And like we did a discussion afterwards in which those critiques were discussed.
Yeah.
So I think that understanding that, so there has to be some people that are meeting other Jews where they're at and doing this work.
Yeah.
But at some point, like the hope, right, is that there will be a transition, right? So like you can almost imagine these people as being like the stewards, right? Like de-Zionizing these people and then kind of passing them on to the next group, which would ideally be JAWS, which is working with more militant non-Jewish organizations such as like Students for Justice in Palestine or the Palestine Youth Movement, like et cetera. So I think like there's, like that's another thing that I really appreciate about JAWS is that at least like in the formation we've seen here, it's like always been really intentionally collaborative with other entities that are like part of this like divest coalition and doing this work that I think something like JVP or If Not Now sometimes can be a bit more insular, which I think is in some ways needed again for like de-Zionizing, right? Like if you're going to have a Shabbat dinner with like the intention of kind of talking to people about de-Zionizing, it might be easier to just have other Jews there. But then these like collaborations like toward this like internationalism, toward like this abolishing of white supremacy and all forms of it, including Zionism,
yeah,
I think needs to happen in a kind of like a harder stance,
yeah,
if that makes sense. Yeah, so it's like collaboration, but not necessarily doing that within JAWS.
That makes sense. I was thinking about that film screening, which I'd say was actually quite a almost historic, like very micro-historic event in the sense that I believe it was an amalgamation of a few different events where it was JAWS, SJP, and then the Tsimtsum Collective, who I have a lot of great admiration and respect for. They do a lot of really important community building amongst Jews here in Santa Cruz, and I hope that we can have Chell, the main organizer there, on the podcast at some point. I know they would be interested. But I remember during the, and I think it's also necessary to say that it wasn't just a film screening, it was also a Shabbat dinner, and it was really beautiful. It was probably like 50 or 60 people there. I remember the same night there was a Rock Shabbat at Temple Beth El, which is something which is like the biggest sort of regular monthly Shabbat service they do. And my parents are very well involved. My dad does sound for it and has been doing sound for it for probably 15 years since they did the first one, like in 2006 or seven. I believe there were significantly more people at this like at this anti-Zionist Shabbat than there were at the synagogue that night, which I think was a really big demonstration of the sort of power that's being built in alternative Jewish spaces right now. And it's really, really important to have that. And it provides so much space for people to grow and to feel at home in their Jewish identities in a time where, like, frankly, it's really hard to wrestle with your Jewish identity or reconcile it with your identity as a socialist or a communist or a progressive or however you might define your politics in this moment. I guess just something I wanted to bring up earlier on the point of abolishing these Zionist Jewish institutions, and if you do think about synagogues as Zionist Jewish institutions, like in Santa Cruz, you do have these alternative groups and congregations even that are being organized in this moment. But you also do have one central Jewish institution that has a building, that has legacy funding, that has the connections to the wider mainstream Jewish communal ecosystem. And it makes it very difficult to imagine a world where we just abolish that rather than trying to engage with it and change it. Because as I know both of you at this point are also involved in the effort to revive the International Jewish Labor Bund, which the core idea of what I'd say is the core innovation of Bundism is this idea of national cultural autonomy, this idea of developing non-territorial self-determination, of cultural autonomy within a wider progressive project. And I think the way that thinking about that relates to understanding a synagogue like that is the fact that that arguably does have a form of cultural autonomy, the fact that there is Jewish educational programming that they host. And of course, the Tsimtsum Collective is actually working to provide an alternative space for Jewish youth education. But But it's hard to just imagine that you could just abolish that without necessarily trying to engage with it, engage with the community, do that de-Zionizing work. And of course, that's probably not the place for JAWS, as you've emphasized. Mm. But as someone that's also on the steering committee for Reform Jews for Justice, that is trying to do this work internally, I guess I think it's just really important to think about this broader movement ecology and how we bring these organizations to kind of synergize across a wider strategy and theory of change. And it's just hard to imagine that in this moment, we're going to be able to get everyone on our side, though, because obviously you go into Temple Beth El and there's a giant printout of the Israeli Declaration of Independence by the door.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's really difficult to wrestle with some of these questions.
I mean, I think that we are seeing attrition, though, from these entities, and their numbers are getting smaller. What I would like to see, we haven't done that much thinking in JAWS about Temple Beth El, like some of the anti-Zionist Jews in Santa Cruz in town have organized some actions around Temple Beth El's events. So like, for example, I was part of there was a Hanukkah celebration at the clock tower downtown, and I was part of a group with some other JAWS comrades who went and just stood with our own signs quietly and made ourselves known that we are anti-Zionist Jews and we aren't affiliated with Temple Beth El because we don't feel comfortable or welcome there. And we deserve to celebrate Hanukkah too.
Yeah.
And so I think like making it clear, like it's not that like we, I think, imagine like all synagogues would be abolished or something in the U.S. because most of them have had like a Zionist history, but it's abolishing the part of them that is Zionist, right? And that like has a connection to Israel. Like every synagogue that might have an Israeli flag up or have the Israeli like Declaration of Independence, like that cannot exist and be part of our Judaism. Like that is not something that like, and I think that's what Jews everywhere are starting to say is like, that is not our Jewishness. And as long as that is being conflated with it, like we don't feel comfortable in those spaces. So like the type of alternate work that Chell is doing at Tzimtzum, I think is amazing. And like, I would like to imagine that what Chell is building will sort of take over for these like really Zionist synagogues, not like Jewish synagogues, right? Like that's what they are. Like, they're Zionizing machines. Obviously, they're places of worship as well and places of learning. But like when people like do their B'nai mitzvahs, they get like money to go to Israel, right? Like that's a thing. Like that cannot be the reward for doing a religious milestone should not be to go to the place that is like actively committing a genocide. Like that's insane. I mean, that's my take on it is like, I would not like to see Temple Beth El continue to exist in its formation, but it's not to say I wouldn't like to see something built in its place.
It is very interesting that you mentioned that you'd like to see Chell's group and groups like that kind of take the place because I mean, I've talked to Chell a lot. We have one-on-ones pretty regularly. What's so interesting about what their group is doing is that it's on paper significantly smaller, like 15, 20 families or something, maybe a bit more. But in terms of engagement, they're regularly having more people attend events than Temple Beth El is. Mm-hmm. Temple Beth El has several hundred families. And at the same time, so few people actually come to regular Friday night services or come to the events that they host. And seeing the ways in which people feel drawn to these alternative spaces in a way that is much more proactive, much more like, I don't want to just support or be part of the synagogue, but I want to really be part of its community, its actual lived social reality, rather than just its sort of on paper existence. I think it does speak to the fact that the dynamics in the Jewish community are changing. It's not hard to imagine that this is a struggle that we could win. And at the same time, it's also incredibly easy, especially if you do just look at mainstream media and perspectives, it's incredibly easy to also imagine that we could lose this fight, that the struggle for how we understand Jewishness could become inextricably tied from Zionism in a way that, like, we say Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel, and some people think Israel, Yisrael, same thing. But at the same time, we know, I mean, something that I've been doing as an educator at Temple Beth El is emphasizing that Yisrael does not mean Israel as a state, as a land. It means one who wrestles with God, Yisrael, the name that Jacob is given after he wrestles with God in the Torah. It's so important to have a space for Jewish learning, and it's so important to recognize, I mean, for me and for Chell, who had my direct boss's job as the director of education at Temple Beth El until last year, it's really important to recognize that if I were not in the position that I am doing that work, no one would be doing that work. And if at worst, someone would be doing the exact opposite work. So I guess it's just really important for me to think about really creatively and constructively engaging with these in a way that isn't just purely oppositional, but trying to find out how we can bridge these gaps. And of course, recognizing that we need to be able to bring Jews into the wider left-wing movement, the wider movement for liberation of all.
I think JAWS fundamentally takes a different approach because JAWS does not believe that these institutions should or can be worked with, but rather understands like abolition from the perspective of like, what can we do right now to build alternative modes of being Jewish, which first of all have existed ever since the invention of Zionism.
Arguably much before the existence of
Zionism. Well, right, exactly. You know, an anti-Zionist Judaism, right, existing ever since that. And so if we're to understand abolition as like the task of building alternative modes of being to replace the carceral, oppressive, you know, ones that are rooted in white supremacy, then we're not going to try to change the existing institutions that are Zionist and oppressive. We are going to build alternative ones. And if people are, you know, feeling so inclined, like they will always be welcome. But I think the way we approach it is no to like normalization, no to reformism. Zionism cannot be reformed. So I think, you know, and it's great, like plurality of opinions, like diversity of tactics. And, you know, Rebecca mentioned earlier, I think de-Zionizing is really important. But something Palestinians have been saying for a long time is that the way Jews have been organizing for Palestine has been really flawed in the way that it focuses on de-Zionizing rather than Palestinian demands and what Palestinians have been saying for a long time. And so, right, because like the work of de-Zionizing, right, liberal Zionists or even less liberal Zionist Jews requires a watering down of Palestinian demands for liberation. And so it's kind of impossible to do that kind of watering down work while also standing in full solidarity with Palestinians. And so that is where we need a plurality of anti-Zionist focused Jewish institutions, right? Where that range from like militant anti-Zionism to that de-Zionizing process. It becomes really difficult when you combine that work and then claim like JVP and If Not Now do that you're in full solidarity with Palestinians, because in reality they are not, because they are actively watering down their demands to make them more palatable to a liberal Zionist, right? That's how I personally understand it. And that's kind of, I believe, where JAWS kind of came into being, was a frustration with the existing anti-Zionist Jewish world and its various institutions. And so I think that's kind of the general orientation.
I think it's really important to understand the positions that JAWS holds. And I will also say that personally, there was one question that was asked at the Israelism screening that was about like, oh, who is the target audience for this? In a way that was framed that I felt was almost punching left, like punching other groups, like If Not Now, I think that was one that was named. And personally, as someone that was sitting in the audience there, Chell's response, which they responded so quickly and are so concise and so articulate, and I felt like there, if they had not been there, it would have gone in the direction, because it was mostly, it was some people from SJP, some people from JAWS, a person from the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism, and then Chell from the Team Zoom Collective. And I felt like if Chell wasn't there, there could have been a much more likely interpretation that groups like If Not Now shouldn't be supported for the roles they play. When I would say that, like, actually, I mean, If Not Now understands itself as an organization that moves people, understands that they want to move people towards more JVP or even JAWS-like positions, while they also think if you want to, I mean, number one rule I learned about organizing is to meet people where they're at so that you can actually have those conversations and get people to start thinking.
Like, something I think about a lot is, like, affect or, like, sort of, like, the emotional climate around, like, where people are. And like for people who are interested in thinking about this, Gabriel Winant has a couple really good pieces One is called We Found Love in a Hopeless Place. It's in N+1, I think, is where it is. And then there is another piece in Descent he wrote recently that is really good in a conversation that's getting at this question. This conversation that he's having via these like letters to the editor with Joshua Leifer. So Joshua Leifer is basically saying, and this is a guy that works for, I believe it's Jewish Currents, and Gabe is a labor historian who's actually coming to our picket line tomorrow, and he's going to be doing a teach-in. But he basically said, like, what Joshua Leifer says is, like, you can grieve for both sides. And then Gabe Winant gets in there and says, no, you can't, because one side gobbles up all of the grief and turns it into a war machine, right? And he calls it the Israeli grief machine. What he's talking about here is like the way that like our affects are weaponized and manipulated, right? And the way that like our emotional attachments to things are manipulated. And so I think going off of what you're talking about with like these different orgs, right, that are doing these different things, it's like we can't ignore the people who have been emotionally manipulated in a certain direction. We do need to, I think, find a way to reach those people, but it can't stop there. And I think that's been the problem up until very recently, is it has, right?
Yeah.
Like it has stopped there. And so that's why I think JAWS is so important, because it comes in and says, like, your consciousness has been raised. Good. Now, like, let's do the real work of like working hand in hand with Palestinians and like listening to what they need from us. Because at the end of the day, once you realize that if you're Jewish, you have no automatic connection to the state of Israel, then why are we any different than anyone else that's doing this work,
yeah,
right? We're not special. We don't know more just because we're Jewish and like have been taught our whole lives that we have an artificial connection to Israel. So once you realize that that doesn't exist, then it's time to just do this work with Palestinian-led orgs, you know? That's why it's been so important, at least on our campus, to like have JAWS out there in these protests with SJP, with the UC Divest Coalition, like taking part in the encampment, taking part in the arrest actions, like doing what needs to be done, rather than sort of saying like, there's something special about our knowledge of Israel, right? Or our knowledge of Palestine. When in reality, like there are historical facts and there are details about what's going on that any of us can learn and any of us can understand to be deplorable and like awful and needing our like all of our resistance against it. The other thing I'll just add real quick though is that like I do think a key important point of having Jews in the movement is I very rarely focus on like the publicity angle, but I think it is important. Like we saw at the start of the encampments all across the country, we saw like seders taking place, right?
Yeah.
And I think like public messaging that like Jews are involved in these movements can also help dispel the notion that like all Jews are Zionists, that real like anti-Semitic myth that like all Jews have some relationship to Israel and Zionism.
It's so dangerous when a lot of the mainstream Jewish institutions are reinforcing that myth.
Right.
And it's extremely dangerous because it just leads people to be like, okay, then we're just going to hate Jews.
Right.
And it's like, well, that's extremely dangerous and ultimately just puts us in more danger than we would be otherwise.
Yeah. And I will say it was amazing. One of my favorite things about that Seder that we had here, this was before the encampment went up, seeing it actually, the photo of it being used in an Algerian newspaper with Arabic writing all around it. And like to see like that being like publicized to like an Arabic speaking audience that often conflates Jewishness with Zionism was like so beautiful.
That's incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
I had actually no clue. And I was there and it was really beautiful just to see the way in which we as Jews can engage with our holidays in a way that emphasizes that they teach us, especially Passover, they teach us about the importance of liberation and importance of freedom. And it's really sad when people take this and are just like, oh, you say next year in Jerusalem in the Seder, right, so it's a Zionist holiday. It's like, well, if you look at the original meaning of it, a lot of the time they would say next year in the Jerusalem that will be built, which was centering the fact that the return to Zion, the return to this place that, I mean, it's objectively true that the land of Israel does play a role in traditional Judaism, but the return to that place was understood to be bound with messianic longing, that we'd only be able to go back there as a people once we live in the world to come, which many Jews have also, especially socialist Jews, have understood as communism, a mm-hmm. world where people beat their swords into plowshares and there's no more war and universal peace and prosperity. Mm-hmm. But I do want to move towards the student movement and such, because we've already been talking for quite a while. But I did also want to go on to the point of these different groups and there being gaps in the movement ecosystem. And part of what I've really been longing for and what I'm hoping the International Jewish Labor Bund could be is a coordinating body between these different groups. Because so often you have all these different groups that have different strategies and see themselves as playing a slightly different role. But if you don't have dialogue between them at multiple levels, at the local level and at the leadership level, they can end up undermining each other in a way that ultimately defeats unity. Like, it makes it much harder for us to win our aims. But at the local level, you guys, Jaws, you've mentioned that you're part of the Divest Coalition. Could you say a little bit about that? And then we're going to connect this to the broader student movement and the demands of the encampment.
Yeah, we joined the Divest Coalition pretty recently. I want to say, actually, I don't even know at this point. It's really hard to judge time. But it's important to emphasize that UC Divest as a formation was started by Palestinians at UCLA. And so divestment from Israel and you know, the Zionist project was always a core piece of Divest. And I think that's huge. And I think that's massively important. And so as an anti-Zionist organization, we were invited to join Divest. And, you know, as a growing coalition on the UCSC campus, which is only just turned a year old. And so definitely a very new formation, an exciting formation. What was really great about the encampment was also seeing how the Divest demand and how organizing for divestment actually transcended the coalition and incorporated hundreds of others from the UCSC community that are not part of one of the coalitional organizations, which I thought was very beautiful.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm less involved with the Divest Coalition. Just, I think, like, it's a lot less common for graduate students to be involved. Although I obviously think that the work that the Divest Coalition is doing is amazing. And I will say, like, divestment is something that we've been organizing around from a labor perspective as well. For example, starting after October 7th, a bunch of STEM workers got together and said, our labs received Department of Defense funding, and we don't want that to be the case anymore. What can we do about this? And what ended up happening was various departments got together, various labs got together and said, let's just talk about it, right? Like, let's just, like, figure out, like, where does our funding even come from? Sometimes workers wouldn't know, like, they wouldn't realize, or they would say things like, well, I received Navy funding, but I feel like I'm doing something good because I'm just researching SEALs. And then you'd be like, but how is this research being used, right? And who has the privilege of using your research and who doesn't? And so these have been amazing conversations that we've been having, like, pretty broadly in STEM departments, which is just incredible, like, to get people that aren't doing what I'm doing for a living, which is, like, reading Marxism all day, right? Like, these people aren't doing that research. So for them to be thinking about this is a huge win in itself. And this has actually now turned into a national, really an international movement of thinking about this. And there's actually going to be a teach-in by the time this airs. Unfortunately, it'll already have happened, but I think it'll probably be recorded. It's a webinar this afternoon that's about this. That's about Researchers Against War and this formation of, like, researchers doing this divestment work. And that comes from people in their workplaces thinking about this, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a way that we can see, I think, like, the student movement dovetailing with the worker movement, which also, I think, like, is clearly related to demands that our union has right now towards transitional funding, away from these DOD-funded labs, basically, right? So, like, get UC central funding to fund us while we transition away from these labs. And also the demands for, like, UC to divest and disclose are part of, like, what I think people are striking over right now. Of course, like, it was the protest that ultimately sparked the strike, but these demands are, like, very key to why people are, like, committed to staying out here and, like, are committed to, like, withholding their labor through June 30th.
Wow. I mean, we didn't really speak much on the encampment yet, But I went there, I only came by a few times just because, I mean, I'm not a student. I felt like this isn't necessarily my struggle. However, I live in Santa Cruz. I care about this issue, these causes. So I was like, I'm going to go. And it's a beautiful atmosphere. The way that community was being built, people were learning together, people were eating together, people were living together in a way that I feel like most of the time in our atomized capitalist society, we don't really do that. And I also want to emphasize just how it seemed like there were a lot of Jews there. And despite the way that the mainstream media framed it as if this was something that was anti-Jewish, there were arguably more Jews there than there were regularly attending Hillel. This is something that Chell told me from some of the conversations they've had. And it's really impressive to see such a large proportion of our community come out and recognize that our liberation is bound to that of the Palestinians and bound to that of all people. And at the same time, divestment is such a important demand because it doesn't necessarily just center Palestine. We can understand it as like a broader consciousness awareness of the fact that these institutions are invested in war. They're invested in climate change. They're invested in all these things that we at universities know we shouldn't be supporting, but then institutionally they do. So it seems really significant because it's bringing a broader awareness of how these institutions ultimately do not uphold the values they claim to, especially when it's like in a classroom, it's much easier to be like, oh yeah, obviously we shouldn't be funding fossil fuels. And then these institutions are like, well, we don't really care about our investment philosophy. We just care about making sure that we have steady growth on our investments. And like, well, it's really important for us to be looking at this and disclosing, having the university disclose where their endowment is invested is a huge step that I feel like is broader than just Palestine. It's much broader than just Palestine and can ultimately move towards a much broader liberation politic that's really intersectional and understands how bound all these things are and ultimately recognizes that capitalism and imperialism, how these are connected, are at its root. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the strike recently that's been ongoing, because legally they're not really supposed to be connected because of labor laws. Yet, as you were saying, there is like a real interpersonal and also they are more connected than they necessarily legally should be. So could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the strike, basically us thinking about taking labor action on this campus came from the call from the General Federation of Palestinian Trade Unions. Does that sound right? Okay. And of course, it's translated from Arabic anyway. But yeah, so like this group, right, like made a call and said on May 1st and May 15th, we want workers all over the world to do a labor stoppage, right? And this was International Workers' Day, May 1st, and Nakba Day, May 15th. And so we got together in mid to late April at our union monthly membership meeting and raised the possibility to workers, what do you all think about this? Could we pull this off? We raised a couple other options. Should we do a strike for 2 weeks in between those 2 days? It would be an unprotected strike at this point, right? We have a no strikes clause in our contract. So you can't just strike for sure, like a small amount of workers doing this just at one campus would have caused firings, right? So we were like, what do you all think about this? Is this something you're willing to get fired for, right? People ended up taking this back to their departments. We got 23 departmental meetings together in a weekend, and people came back on Tuesday, April 30th to take a vote. What do we want to do? And overwhelmingly, a huge majority in the room decided we 100% want to go out on May 1st. Let's do a one-day wildcat walkout. So we did that. And then we said, and let's come together in a week's time and try to get some demands together, because there was also an appetite for going on a sustained demands-based strike. People were not willing to go on like a two-week solidarity strike and get fired for no demands, but they were willing to like walk off the job on May 15th and stay out. And so we said, okay, let's come back together after a demands working group has met to address what maybe we would be willing to strike over. So we come up with these demands. And then in this period of time, We saw the UCLA encampment get swept. We saw workers go out there and defend their students. Also, workers were camping, right? UAW members were camping. We saw them brutalized by a Zionist mob while the police just sat and watched. And then we saw the police that the UC called on them wearing riot gear, LAPD, brutalize and arrest close to 250 people, many of whom were also workers, UAW workers. We then saw a very similar scene at UC San Diego, and we saw another similar scene at UC Irvine. And then, of course, most recently, we saw this here at UC Santa Cruz just a couple nights ago. And that was the impetus for our union filing unfair labor practice charges over workplace health and safety violations, right? You can't let your workers be brutalized by police, let alone call police to brutalize them. Also, a violation of our First Amendment right to free speech, right, and peaceful protest. So we file these unfair labor practice charges. The UC says they still maintain we didn't do anything wrong, right? But it's clear what they did was unlawful. And this opens the door, once you file unfair labor practice charges, this opens the door to a legal strike. So that means that your no strikes clause doesn't matter. So we now have been able to legally call a strike authorization vote. And that happened between May 13th and May 15th. And 80% of workers that voted in that, which was a supermajority of workers, voted yes. Mm-hmm. So that means like people are down, right? This is across all 10 campuses. This is huge.
Could you say a little bit about what the specific, besides you mentioned a couple unfair labor practices, but what the demands are and what are the other unfair labor practices that are being raised?
Yeah, so the unfair labor practices were over these like brutal arrests of workers who were standing in solidarity with Palestine, right? So when we were getting ready for the strike authorization vote, our union's joint council met up. There's about 100 of us who are like voting members in that joint council, and we discussed demands. And there was a proposal for amnesty for all protesters, divestment, disclosure, affirmation of right to exercise First Amendment right, and the transitional funding that I've already mentioned, which is about UC centralized funding going to workers that morally object to working in a lab that's contributing towards the genocide or anything, honestly, like any other militarization as well. So we saw these demands picked up, right? And like they're on our website. Like it's clear that this is like been stated that this is something workers have been protesting for and care about. But what we are technically striking over are these unfair labor practice charges, which are about our workplace conditions, right? Like even people in my department who have never gone on strike, did not go on strike during the Wildcat, did not go on strike during the 2022 strike for 6 weeks. They are now striking because they are like, this is so fucked up that I could be like just going to defend my student from getting beaten by a baton or like getting maced, and I could end up getting like arrested and brutalized, right? Like we can't let that precedent like set in as being something the UC can just do when their workers are like peacefully assembling to protest something in good conscience.
Yeah.
So like it is a workplace issue, right? But it also is like the impetus for this workplace issue are these protests in solidarity with Palestine.
Yeah.
So, like, we would not be here at all without, like, the student movement and what it's been building really since, like, October.
Yeah. Max, could you say a little bit about the repression that the encampment has been facing or has faced over the last several days?
It was interesting, right? Because the encampment lasted a total of 31 days. And we did not see police repression until the moment it was dismantled, right? I think a lot of other encampments experienced police presence during their encampment and then, of course, during the dismantling, but ours did not see police presence. The school actually hired a private security firm to surveil us. But then all of a sudden, I'm at the encampment around 11:45 p.m. on Thursday night.
What was the date of that?
So that's going to be May 30th. And then all of a sudden, like, 5 Santa Cruz police cars pull up and we're like, okay, this is the moment. And so then, I mean, we had intel that UCSC had called for mutual aid is what they call it. and for UC Davis and UC Berkeley. So we knew those cops were in town. We actually had someone working at a hotel who noted how many cops were staying there. And so we knew it was imminent, right? But it was just like, there were around 40 or 50 of us in the encampment at like 11:45 on May 30th. And it was like, oh, it's time. And so we mobilized as fast as we could. We put out call out posts. And next thing you know, within the next hour, we have like probably 400 people down at the encampment. It's 12:30. And then, so it was just those five Santa Cruz police cars right in front of the main entrance. But then we started to see just like hordes and hordes and hordes of riot cops coming down the hill from like East Remote. So they had actually staged on campus, which I'm like, is that even legal?
So were they kind of kettling you from both sides?
So kind of, right? But like it was only five police officers at the entrance. Also, like the encampment has stated since day one that we are either leaving if divestment happens or if we are forcibly removed, right? So no one was going to leave, right? And so basically, yeah. So I would say the first wave of cops was around like 200 of them, riot police from over 20 different police departments from all over Northern California. We had people from everywhere from South San Francisco to Foster City to Pacifica to, I mean, just every Bay Area city, there were cops from there. And so they, I don't think, anticipated our numbers. And so it took them actually a long time to actually descend on us because they were, I think, very much taken by surprise. And they actually called reinforcements, even though they already had so many people, right? And so then they first take down the encampment, they destroy all the tents, and then they come for our line, which was kind of stretching the entire width of those two streets.
And I do think it's important to emphasize that you guys, you had a barricade at the main entrance, and it was at least 2 or 3 days that you effectively had UCSE campus cut off from the rest of Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and that was a direct escalation. That was in response to admin's complete unwillingness to meet any of our demands to even negotiate in good faith. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of just at a point where it's like, you've left us no choice. You know, like part of moving the encampment to the base of campus was also like they effectively were able to hide us away and ignore us there, right? So moving it to the base was, yes, to stand in solidarity with UAW, but also to increase visibility and be like, you can't ignore us, right?
Yeah.
And so basically, yeah, so we had a line of people that was about 4 to 5 people deep, the entire thing, you know, people had found helmets, goggles. I mean, we didn't really know what to expect, right? I mean, they brought their tear gas, they brought their rubber bullet guns, they brought their real guns, and they brought their huge wooden batons. And again, they're in full riot gear. But eventually they were able to basically target the ends of the lines and get us into a circle, which is very effective for them. Ultimately, we did our best to like push back, but there were so many of them. And, you know, they were like, I mean, I got aggressively hit several times by this one guy with the, you know, this wooden stick. They would just like basically just go for the ribs and just like hit you back. Right. And to like really form us into a circle in which they could then encircle us. And what was interesting was that UCPD was the only one that could arrest people. So basically you have police from 20 different departments effectively acting as like the kind of like the minions of UCPD and just like pushing the crowd back and surrounding us. California Highway Patrol was a big force there. And that's directly because of Gavin Newsom. Those are kind of his foot soldiers. And so then UCPD finally, this was around like 1 a.m. started to arrest people. And how they would do it is they just had a little posse that would kind of walk around the circle and then just point at someone and say like you, and then they like all pounce on you and just try to grab you out of the circle. But because of the way we're in formation, right, we were locking arms, and then the people behind us would be like holding us from like our stomachs. It was incredibly difficult for them to get one by one people out of the circle. And so that's why you had arrests being made for over 8 hours. It took them forever to get us out of this circle. And there's some great moments on video in which they actually were unsuccessful. They could not get the person out of the circle. And I'm like, okay, if we're going to say we keep us safe, this is what we keep us safe looks like. And so it was both an incredibly scary moment and also an empowering moment, right, to be so close to a riot police officer, to hundreds of riot police officers with deadly weapons and with this extreme aggressiveness and just chauvinism. And then to also see how our community showed out for us, how everyone was just committed to staying. And we chanted and we stood there for, I mean, I was there for 7 hours until I got arrested around 6:45 a.m. It also took a while for Santa Clara Sheriff Department to bring all their vans and their buses to take us away because they didn't have the cars to take us away. There was just too many of us. And I just don't think they were prepared for that. I think they had a lot of surveillance on the encampment. They were seeing 40 or 50 people there on a regular given basis. So they're like, okay, we can do this nice and quick. I remember one of the officers just like muttering under his breath, like very frustratingly, like was like, God damn, like you guys are so committed, right? It was like 3 a.m. at that point, and we were just kept chanting and kept standing there and kept locking arms. And they were just like really frustrated because it was taking so long.
Yeah.
So, but it was really gnarly. I mean, people were hospitalized. Professors were injured to the point of like visible injuries.
I saw a picture of someone who had been arrested, had a plastic bag.
Yeah,
they
bagged someone. They gave numerous people concussions. It was really gnarly and certainly could have been a lot worse, right? I'm not saying that it wasn't bad in any way. I'm just saying like with that amount of force, with that, you know, with cops being, you know, with cops being on campus like that, like it is such a safety risk. And that's what's so egregious about all these communications we're getting from the administration, right? This is about your safety. This is about campus safety. And I'm like, you did the one thing that makes us the most unsafe, right? And Lori Kletzer, you know, our vice chancellor, actually had the audacity to come and walk her dog as if nothing was happening, just to watch what was happening, quite literally when like riot police were beating up her students. So it was just like a crazy scene. And ultimately over 100 of us were arrested, and most of us got like unlawful assembly, failure to disperse misdemeanor charges. Some people were, you know, charged with battery. I mean, ridiculous instances of that charge, right? Like someone spit on the ground and an officer said that was battery. And we all, most of us got banned from campus for 2 weeks.
Yeah. And that's crazy when a lot of you live on campus.
Live on campus, are graduating.
Does that mean you're effectively homeless?
Yes. They made like tens of students homeless. They made workers be unable to get to their jobs. They made students who are graduating be unable to attend their own graduation. Thankfully, the encampment is putting on its own people's commencement off campus now. Right. But it's just like, every accusation they make of us is a confession as to like their own brutality and their own contempt for their like students. And so I think it's just really important to recognize that.
Just the claim that the vice chancellor said that, oh, this is for your safety, almost reminds me a lot of the way that like anti-Zionist protests are treated vis-a-vis the Jewish community. Like, oh, we're cracking down on these mass movements for your safety, even though there's a lot of Jews taking part in these movements.
The other thing that's important, I think, to note here is that these 2 week suspensions are also unlawful, that everyone is supposed to have a hearing before they can be given this 2 week suspension. And so to give everyone, people got it in their like paperwork when they were being discharged from police custody. There was no hearing of any kind. I know of at least one person who lives at family student housing and got this and has two children under five. What are they supposed to do without their mother for 2 weeks? I mean, this is really unbelievable, you know? And this is like, they're citing that this is like continual endangerment of the campus community, which is what they say enables them to do this. But I'm going to be like, as like a UAW rep, I'm going to be repping our UAW members who are arrested. And like, we think that that's just completely illegal justification of what they're saying. I mean, it is unthinkable that a mother who was there as a legal observer watching and was ultimately arrested because the police kettled her into this group, right? Like that she would then be given a 2 week suspension from being in the home where her children live. So I think that this is like really something that honestly, like it's completely unthinkable that the UC called in this type of excessive force on everyone, but they've honestly created a worse legal situation for themselves. And we're going to be filing more on fair labor practices over it because they really did a lot of illegal things in the process of breaking up this.
I think it's also important to note, too, that that two-week ban from campus is very deliberate to prevent any more organizing.
Yeah.
This school is so done, right, with the amount of disruption we have caused it, which has been amazing to see. But they're like, how do we get rid of these freaking people? And they're like, oh, ban them from campus.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Like, when I was in Israel-Palestine last May, a lot of the, like, people with Israeli citizenship who were protesting with, when they were arrested, they were given effectively an injunction against protesting. Like, if you are protesting again for a month or 3 months or something, then they'll arrest you and you'll get worse charges. And it seems to me like they could have done something like that, where it's not like you're not allowed to be in the space. It's more just you're not allowed to protest, and that would still accomplish the goal. So it seems escalatory to do that, to say you're not even allowed to step foot on the campus. And these are the next 2 weeks where there's finals, there's graduation, as you were saying. It's really, it's really something. It's really a choice that is pretty egregious.
Certainly a choice. And I think that everyone, you know, understood how much contempt the UCSC administration had for its students and workers prior to this police raid, right? It was not something that was up for question, but I think, you know, this police raid, like, really confirmed just their, like, absolute disregard for the safety and well-being of their students and workers.
So we've been talking for, like, an hour and 12 minutes at this point, but I just wanted to ask you guys to wrap up, what now? Like, where do things go from here? The semester is starting to wrap up, or quarter, I don't remember what year.
Quarter, yeah.
The quarter is starting to wrap up, but, like, it doesn't seem like any of the demands are being met or even considered to being met.
Mm.
Where do we go from here? What happens? How do you understand the current moment we sit in and what might come next?
Well, I think UAW workers on our campus are more committed than ever to staying on strike. We tomorrow have an Amnesty for All rally that we're really mobilizing people for, which is, just to be clear about, like, locationally where it is, like, this is going to be in the location that students were literally arrested and put into vans, right? Of course, some students won't be able to attend, but they can be across the street, and that's not university property. And we'll have it loud and proud on speakers for everyone to hear that, like, we are not going anywhere until amnesty is granted for all the protesters. And, like, that means dropping criminal charges, dropping student conduct charges, dropping these suspensions, right? Of course, we'll see which comes first. If the 2 weeks come first to the end of the term, we authorized our strike to go through June 30th. And that's after the grading deadline. We're currently doing the work of figuring out exactly what that damage will be to the university, but it's going to be thousands of grades that we're withholding. Thousands. And then the university is going to have to figure out, how do they make sure all these students that were supposed to graduate this quarter get to graduate? How do students that needed a class for their GPA to count, but that are now getting a pass grade instead of an actual letter grade, what are they going to do about that? So our goal is to maximally disrupt the university until it forces them to negotiate with us and accept our demands for divestment, disclosure, amnesty, transitional funding, et cetera.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the sentiment of grinding the university to a halt until demands are met is where I see this movement going. I think the encampment was an incredible learning experience as to what is going to get this administration to move, right? The encampment itself did not sway the administration in any way. They honestly were fine with letting it continue forever. What really gets this administration is the road blockages, is, you know, these kind of more material disruptions of university activity, of capital flow. And so I think they should anticipate more of that. Cynthia, you know, Chancellor Cynthia and the Vice Chancellor Lori can certainly expect to never show their faces again on campus without disruption. I mean, I think it's just, again, like, so egregious, you know, how they've acted and how Lori just thought she could peacefully walk her dog while her students were getting beaten by riot police. And, like, I mean, there's this great picture of her just smiling, you know, watching it all happen. I mean, these people cannot claim to serve students and workers and show up on our campus and feel like they are welcome. Like, they're never going to be able to set foot on campus again without being disrupted. I think that's something that they can expect. And then the encampment also mobilized a ton of people that were not previously in organizing spaces on campus, and a lot of first years. I mean, that was something that was really striking to me, was the amount of first years, right? It gave me hope, right? And so I think we're going to have to really make a concerted effort to like sustain our energy throughout the summer, right? Because that is like the death to college campus organizing. But I am hopeful about it. And I think that also the encampment was like a great experiment in like organizing that incorporates like the building of alternative spaces, right? Because like, you know, the rallies, the building occupations, all the other actions that, you know, SJP, JAWS, Divest have taken prior to the encampment, you know, certainly are to make a statement of condemnation and to assert our demands, right? But they weren't necessarily like, this is the university we want to see. And so we did 31 days of that. We did serve 3 meals a day for free to anyone, right? We did have a people's university that had constant programming, you know, from people coming down from the Bay. I mean, Angela Davis came, you know, so many amazing sessions and, you know, safety trainings and all sorts of stuff were held. And so like, we really demonstrated like, okay, like, yes, these are our demands, but this is like, we can make these spaces in the meantime. Abolition is not necessarily this abstract future. It's actually like the actions that we take, you know, every single day to fill the gaps of insecurity and of unsafety that the state puts us in. And we need to do that work, because otherwise the state will fill those gaps with very reactionary models of quote unquote safety, as we've seen from this administration that thinks safety is sending hundreds of riot police on their students. So I think like maybe in the future, seeing more of that, like building of alternative spaces, I hope People's University continues into next year. We'll see.
I'm also going to echo what my brother has emphasized, which is the fear of backlash. Because I don't know, I mean, it's probably mostly bullshit, but you could see it, the UCSC's Reddit page was full of people being like, this is terrible. These are all Hamas protesters.
Right.
They're all, and I put Hamas on intentionally because that's the way the Zionists will often frame it and use the word. But it's really incredible to be able to situate the work that you guys have been doing at UCSC into the wider UC movement, because I remember when I was a student, the desire to have like a joint student faculty movement is like, the potentials of that are enormous. Next thing is to bring in this like the service workers that work on campus to really build the opposition,
who by the way are currently organizing. We have dining workers organizing, undergraduate dining workers, the non-student dining workers are also represented by AFSCME, and we have like very good relationships with these folks in AFSCME who also are the transportation workers on our campus. And like in our strike, we've also not seen, you know, Metro buses haven't been crossing our picket. Teamster drivers that drive in like UPS haven't been crossing our picket. So like getting this like worker student solidarity is absolutely essential to continuing the movement.
Yeah, and it's something that is happening all over the place. Like, you have so many encampments in the last month all across the country, all across the world, that have been calling for the same demands. Like, that is historic. That is something that isn't going to stop here, and we will see what the long-term consequences are. But as you're saying, there is a lot of organizing taking place amongst workers. The last episode we did on labor union stuff was actually with a professor of mine at Colgate named Laura Jaffe, who now has been pushed out of higher ed and is a organizer for SEIU at Syracuse and has been organizing dining hall workers and such there. And the sort of intersection between these issues of Palestine solidarity and even, you could say, Jewish politics, diasporist politics, politics that focus on the ability to have cultural autonomy in the places we live and in the wider movements, is connecting to labor issues. And it feels like we haven't really seen that until the last several months. And it's really historic to see. And it's also potentially scary. I mean, we know what happened after the 1946 strike wave. We had Taft-Hartley implemented, which cut back on the ability to strike, the ability to have wildcat strikes, to have political strikes, and the fear that that could play again. We could see the same thing happen, especially if Donald Trump wins the election in November.
Well, I would just say to that, like, the key is continuing to build rank and file movements, because the only thing that can break a strike is workers walking back on the job, right? Like, It's like the law isn't going to break a strike. The boss is always going to do illegal shit. Like, we've been seeing that. Like, why are we supposed to expect it to be legal, right? Like, about all of our strikes when the boss isn't going to be legal. Like, our campus went on a wildcat strike in 2019, 2020. Like, strikes don't need to be legal to be effective. So, like, whatever happens in response to this upsurge, like, I think it's important to just, like, stay steady, make sure that, like, we maintain our organizing networks and that, like, in the downtime, we, like, keep up these organizing meetings and these, like, community building events and, like, that we stay steady because, like, this movement has been so essential to, like, rebuilding a lot of our networks that have been shattered by some of the things you've mentioned. So I think stay steady. That's what I think.
Any last words for you, Max?
I think like fear of repression is real, but like any organizing that is effective is going to face repression. And I think we just have to be ready for that and that we can, again, like modeled after the encampment, really like build these spaces, these communities, these models of we keep us safe that can endure, you know, whatever the state throws at us. Because if there's anything that I took away from that police, you know, atrocity raid is that, you know, fascism is already here, right? And it's been here, you know, people, I mean, George Jackson was writing about this in 1970. Like, if we understand fascism to be like the epitome of capitalism and the unleashing of a police state to defend the ruling class, the upper class, then that is precisely what we saw happen on the night of May 30th and the morning of May 31st, right? Using, you know, the police state's forces to crush an encampment demanding divestment, right? Divestment being a threat to the function of capitalism and its relationship to imperialism, but also just like the ruling class, right? That is what the UC Regents are ultimately. They're a manifestation of that. And they are, you know, the ones in charge of the UC investments. So I think that fascism's already here. And then it's like, okay, how are we going to organize our communities and our spaces in ways that can keep us safe? And yeah, can't be too afraid of the repression because, I mean,
you can't let it stop us.
Yeah, no, it's inevitable. And that's, you know, throughout history, we've seen people who have been willing to be brave and been willing to really put themselves out there and really fight for what they believe in, because what else are we doing, you know, if not that? So
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think the idea of we keep us safe is really core to how I understand diasporism in the Jewish context, and thinking about how we really need to be bringing more and more Jews onto the side of Palestinian liberation, because ultimately the number one effective attack against this movement is the claims of anti-Semitism, which I hope we directly discuss in a future episode, because it is incredibly problematic, and the instrumentalization of anti-Semitism is something that, I mean, it basically took Corbyn out of his position as the head of the Labour Party in 2019. And it's something that is ultimately one of the strongest cudgels against a unified left-wing movement in the current moment. And it's so important for us to be able to bring our community onto the side of it. So I really wanted to thank you so much for all the work you guys do with JAWS, with the UAW, community. And I hope you guys continue to make waves and we build the better future together.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having us.
Free Palestine. L'chaim intifada.
L'chaim intifada. I love
that. Sing for justice. Sing for joy.